Hello, and welcome to episode 196 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Today we're asking this. Why do we romanticize the Amish while ignoring the harms within their communities? The idea for this episode began a few weeks ago when I was scrolling through Facebook. I saw a post criticizing a particular national retailer for backing away from DEI commitments, and then just a few posts later, someone promoting a map of local Amish greenhouses celebrating the return of good and simple living. That contrast made me wonder, why are some groups held to intense public scrutiny, while others, such as the Amish, often praised without much critical thought? From horse-drawn buggies to homemade goods, the Amish are often held up as an example of a pure, faith-filled life. But beneath the charm are real ethical questions about control, inequality, and community impact. So, Rick, let's start here. Why do you think we're so quick to idealize the Amish without talking much about the costs?
I think, first of all, because most of us don't know that much about the Amish. What we see is kind of the outside of the community life, and those are things like you go to the greenhouse and there's really good plants.
For cheap.
For cheap. And, like, there's certain things about the lifestyle that really appeal to us because there's a kind of a sentimental attachment, I think, for many people to the idea of a simpler lifestyle. And we maybe have grandparents or great-grandparents who, you know, grew up with horses and buggies.
Kind of the Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Yeah.
Life.
So there's that sentimental idea. I think there are deeper reasons also. And I think that has to do with some of the things that are troubling us most about our society. And like what we find, especially among many young people right now, is a real desire for belonging. The Amish have belonging. Like, these are communities.
Yes, that very tight-knit communities.
Very tight-knit, and where everybody is useful, everybody has a place, and these are things that we don't have. So there's trade-offs, and what we have in our society, kind of this highly developed, economically progressive, industrialized culture, is we have a lot of individual freedom, but we don't have equality, right? We have great kind of social and economic inequality. The Amish have great equality.
Well,
economic, like what we talk about, like, They have a certain kind of social equality that, like, there's other kinds. We can talk about that. But what they don't have is much individual freedom.
And I guess just to start with what I opened the show with, and I'm just kind of, and we can kind of move into some of the details about the Amish as we continue on. But I want to make sure that you're clear that sort of the what really jumped out at me is there, and I think this was Target, and it doesn't matter because there's other examples like that, but there are a certain group of people, mostly on the left, who are upset with Target dropping its DEI programming and some other changes they made corporately that makes some on the left less likely to shop there. And they like to talk about that a lot. And again, please shop where you want to shop. That's fine. But it just seems odd that the same people who are like, gosh, I don't feel like Target's DEI corporate policy quite matches what I think it should be or what I would like if I ran the company, but, you know, I'll be more than happy to go shop at some Amish greenhouse because I'm supporting some wonderful little enterprise. But they don't realize, and I think this is true, is that if you looked at the average, like, MAGA supporting male in our society and what he might believe, and I'm sure these beliefs are in stark contrast to what these people who are upset about Target's practices. I promise you that MAGA man is so much more progressive than any man in the Amish community. And I just think to say otherwise is just not true. And I just worry that we sort of look at this sort of old-timey charm of this part of our country, which, by the way, estimates are there's 900,000 Amish people in this country. And again, they're clustered in certain parts of our, mostly the eastern half of the U.S. But we just sort of look at this, like you said, of this sort of hearkening back to the past and the good old days without giving like critical thought as to the practices around shunning and abuse. And you mentioned freedom. Sure, there may be some equality when it comes to how there aren't these great stratifications when it comes to economic class in these culture, in that culture. But like, especially if you're a woman, and especially if you want to like have a career, I mean that's just laughable. That is just not going to happen. Or if it is happen, you're going to be entirely removed from this community forever. And children growing up there don't get the education that like almost everybody else does. They, in many cases, ignore modern medicine. I mean, all these things that just seem so backward to me, and it just seems so hypocritical that the people who support these companies and these businesses think it's okay, but then would never shop with Amazon because Amazon said something nice about Donald Trump once.
Well, I'm really surprised that you are surprised by inconsistencies in how we think about, like, put things into certain categories and then stop thinking about them. Well, that's human nature. We do that all the time.
Well, that's why we're having this topic on this show, because it just made me grumpy and I wanted to have a show about it.
But then let's talk about some of the specific things that you said. Well, what about shunning?
Yes.
I think we practice shunning in our culture all the time. We just do it in different ways. And this is mainly what social media does, is like it's mob shunning, like demanding that somebody get fired because they tell a joke and it's an off-color joke. It's not politically acceptable joke. And people can't wait to pile on to get the person fired because it's not socially acceptable. So we practice shunning all the time. And so, like, isn't that hypocritical to condemn it in one society while we practice it in ours?
Yes. I mean, every society shuns to some degree, but I think it is remarkably awful to say to someone, I'm going to guess the age here, but certainly late teens, 16, 17, 18, where there seems, again, and I'll pause here for a moment. I did have a conversation a couple of days ago with someone who is much better connected to the Amish community than I am, who has relationships with some of the people in the community around us in the Amish world. So did give me some background here. He sort of outlined that there in most Amish communities, there's a point where an older teen has the opportunity to sort of explore the world and what's the term I always have such a hard time pronouncing, maybe the Rumspringa. Thank you. Where they have the opportunity to like go out and see what the real world's like.
Yeah, it literally means running around.
It does. Oh, it's interesting. And yeah, most of them, after doing that, not all, but most, come back to the Amish community because they realize that if they decide to go and follow the path of like most of, as they refer to it, the English, which is like everybody that's outside of their community, that they can do that and they can go to college or get a job or join the military or any of these things. But by doing that act, they will sever all ties to the community. If someone can come home on holidays and weekends, you're just sort of gone. And that seems like a whole lot worse than some acquaintance or stranger piling on for you telling an off-color joke. These are the people who are supposed to love and care about you more than anything. But if you make a choice with which they disagree, well, you're sort of dead to them. And that seems like a really bad thing.
Yeah, but put it in the bigger picture. Right now, we talk a lot about the loneliness epidemic.
Yes.
Among we have young people who many go off to college and then leave their communities, go off into some new communities and find themselves with a lack of friends and a lack of real meaningful community participant. So they find themselves in that same area, kind of abandonment of really deep, meaningful social ties.
But they can like still text their mom if they're sad.
Yeah, but what they desire is something deeper. And so like you have people within the Amish community who have those much deeper connections. And it's no surprise to me that they would say they want to maintain them. And that like one of the one of the costs is you can't have it both ways. I mean, if you don't have a community with a set of real criteria for who counts as in and out, at some point you lose any sense of community at all. That's basically what we've opted for in Western societies, is not really to have meaningful community. Sebastian Junger wrote about this in his book Tribe, and like how there's all these cases in early American colonial times of cases of people from these kind of Western community settlements running off to join native tribes, but you didn't have anybody from the native tribes joining the English or Dutch or German settlements, because there's a real close sense of community involvement. And in a way, you don't have the same sort of emphasis on individual identity. You have a communal identity. And you can't have communal identity without criteria for being in or out of the community.
But all those things you say are true. But I think it's also okay to look at those communities and say, great, they seem to be tightly knit. They seem to be very caring about each other. They seem to form these strong bonds. But like, also, it's probably okay to say they don't treat their women equally or very well, that education is not valued in any strong, significant way. Basic things around healthcare are just sort of ignored. I mean, according to my friend, that it's there's not a prohibition on seeking medical treatment in most of these communities. But oftentimes, if you get, you know, very sick, it's often looked at as, well, this is just sort of God's how things are playing out, and we'll hope for the best. And in many cases, hoping for the best doesn't work, because there are real treatments out there, but they just don't think that's the path they take. And I just don't know.
The life expectancy among the Amish is somewhere around like 7-8 years lower than average Americans in general.
Yeah.
And lots of times they'll get treatment for real, like serious diseases, but they often get detected much later because they aren't going in for routine or preventive care. Overall, with the exception of those kinds of serious diseases, they're often much healthier. So,
well,
they're much more active.
They're obviously not sitting in an office chair 7, 8, 9 hours a day.
So obesity rates among the overall population in America right now is around 35%.
Sure.
It's really high. It's around 5% for the Amish.
Yeah.
They eat better food. They don't eat highly processed food.
I bet it's almost all organic. And again, fine. But like,
they don't spend a whole bunch of their income as community taking care of people in the last few weeks of life.
That,
right,
I would imagine true.
Yeah. So,
and
they've been people die.
All, many of them die. Most die at home, probably. I don't know that, but I would guess that's often.
They have much lower suicide rates. That's significant. I mean, we have a real high problem. It's something like 15 or 16 people out of 100,000 people as our suicide rate for overall in the United States, and in the Amish. It's somewhere between 1 to 5. It's really hard to get different studies say different
it's
things.
Hard. And they're not, you know, they're not answering phones and answering surveys and that stuff. So it's tough to gather data,
but
I
then,
suppose.
Like, think about something like abuse. And there are publicized cases sometimes of abuse. And you often get this in any kind of rural communities which are separated. And yet, I would guess that there's a much greater knowledge of what's going on among different people. Like, they have such stronger social networks.
Mm-hmm.
They have a much better idea of what's going on among our neighbors than we do. And our police force right now, the number one call that they're getting is domestic abuse.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so and maybe the number one call they don't want to get too.
Yeah. So like we have domestic abuse that just rampant in our society. And so these are really hard things to compare, but I would think, like the average child, I would just think, like, you're talking about protecting from abuse, probably going to be better off in an Amish community than in a typical American one.
I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, maybe. I just am very skeptical that setting up these isolated and insular groups that are sort of outside of law enforcement's control in many, many cases, who don't really oftentimes play by governmental rules. I know the friend who I was speaking with said that in his experience, it's, and these are in, again, very rural parts of our state, will often just build things without thinking about getting permits or zoning. And sometimes government officials hold them accountable for that. Sometimes they don't. There's sort of a, in some parts of our state, sort of a realization that we just, the government just sort of treats them differently. And they do pay property taxes, as far as my friend says, and I think that would be hard not to. I mean, they do often own large swaths of land, but like, they're just not participating in our larger society in any significant ways. And I guess where I will push back a little bit is, or maybe more than a little bit, is that you wrote a book about how important it is to engage in third places and not just sit around and stew with your problems all alone. And I think you have said, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that these, the best of third places sort of bring people from all walks of life together. And it's a great way where if you're some lefty, where you might strike up a conversation with some MAGA person and think, gosh, you know, maybe we have more in common than we might think. And I think that's probably a good thing. And that you have these places where people from all backgrounds mix and match and get to know each other. And that's something that as a society, we've certainly lost over the past few generations. And when we used to have things like Elks clubs and Rotary groups and all these things, and that as a society, we're just lacking this. And you're saying, well, this little group does a great job in these small little insular communities. But if to step out of that world is like not encouraged. And my friend said very clearly that what you see, how the Amish interact with the English or the public or the people outside of their community is very different than how they interact with those inside their community. And I don't see any real benefit to any of that. And I'm surprised in some ways you do, based on things we've talked about on the show in previous episodes.
I am a big fan of cultural diversity. And what that means is that you have to have a pretty high tolerance for groups, social groups, to maintain kind of criteria for what counts as belonging within that group. Now, I would draw the line if they're using coercion or manipulation or deception to try to recruit and bring people in. And we oftentimes talk about cults that do this.
And I think anybody who knows anything about the Amish says the last thing they are is trying to recruit new members. You know, they will certainly in their families try to keep things in the family, but they don't try to proselytize.
Right. And they even have, as we mentioned, this Rumspringa, where some of the young Amish, like when they're between about 16 and 20 or 21, they'll live with a real relaxation of the rules, of many of the rules, and participate in some of the things that the English do. And some of them then decide that they would choose not to come back, right? So there are those opportunities for opting out of that kind of life. But I think we're better off as a society overall to have a number of different groups like this where people are making experiments in different forms of living and for there to be the opportunity to have like these real rich experiences. And there's a trade-off. You have a greater sense of belonging, like people in Amish communities are, they know that they're useful to the community. Right now, like in Western societies, we're having a crisis of uselessness where people just don't feel like they're needed, especially young people.
Well, you don't have electricity. It changes everything.
It does. But there's these trade-offs. I would not want to join an Amish community.
They may not want you.
Right. But I think it's good that we have groups that are really distinctive and that are doing that. But one of the costs of that distinctiveness is that they are different, and they have criteria for their difference.
We have a long history in this country, and we should be proud of this history, that we have freedom of religion. And we, I guess we haven't talked a lot about this discussion of in our discussion today, the Amish, but a lot of this is predicated on some closely held religious beliefs that this community has. And so I think as a society, we do have the responsibility to say, just like we think being Methodist is okay, we also think that being practicing Amish is okay. And again, that's more than a religion, is also sort of a whole lifestyle infrastructure. That said, that and this is where I want to be really clear, that I'm not accusing the Amish of doing these sort of things. But if somebody spun up a religion that included murdering children, taking it as far as one could go, obviously we would step in and say, well, that's a religion we just can't have. I mean, we're not going to let people go out there and murder people because that they say that they're sacrificing young folks to the gods. I mean, that would be crazy. And I think almost everyone would say we should act there. But so I use that illustration just to say that there is a line, right? That there is a line where we say that, yeah, we respect freedom of religion up until a point. And
we haven't drawn that line very thoroughly. Like as you were pointing out at the beginning of the show, we don't really even think about the line very much until some group has gone way over it.
But if you just said generically that there is a group of 900,000 Americans, and I would call them Americans, I don't know if they would consider themselves to be Americans, that have significant below average health outcomes, who are on the education side, have very low, compared to their peers, educational abilities, and that they're also quite repressive in how they treat certain members of their society, maybe women especially, that if you just kind of laid out those three tenets and said, what should we do something about that? I think the average person would say, well, yeah, we need to make sure that we're giving these people help, that we're giving them the healthcare that they need and that they should have, that we are providing them with their children with a good education that prepares them for life in a complicated world, that we should do all these things that like regular people have access to. But then we learned, it's the Amish. Well, that's fine. Don't worry about it. They're sort of out on their own and that's okay. And I think part of it's because in most parts of the country, they live behind the hill and you never really see them. But I just don't think that we should be so quick to say, well, because there's some sort of, because of the way they choose to live, we'll just sort of overlook these, in my mind, awful things they do to the people who live in that community.
I think part of it is that they're actually, by many measures, they're flourishing. I mean, I think everything you just said could be said of many Native American communities, though, living on reservations.
Well, absolutely, and I would say that's also bad, and we should be ashamed of how we got into that situation, and we should do something about it.
But we also do spend much more, like in federal funds and
trying to get healthcare access and things like that.
But with much worse outcomes. The Amish, relative to like the indigenous community, say on Pine Ridge Reservation, the Amish seem to be flourishing. They're buying farms, so their communities are growing, and so that, and then they're relying on any kind of government assistance for the support of these communities. And so I'm having trouble seeing, like, how do you think, like, if we tried to support them, in what way would that make them better? I think it might hurt them.
I probably should have said this at the start of the show. I have very little firsthand experience with Amish people other than I see them sometimes, and that's about it. But I just can't help but practice some empathy, which is a topic we've discussed on the show, for I'll specifically say a young woman in a Amish society who, whether she knows it or not, is living in an insular community inside a much larger country, where because of the place she was born into, will have remarkably fewer opportunities to grow as a person and to learn about things and to make choices for herself than almost anyone else in this country. And there's hundreds of thousands of these young people in this country right now who, yes, have in almost every case loving parents and a community that cares for them, but also so few choices other than, I suppose, the one looming ultimate choice when they're like 18, where they get to either go out and explore the world around them, which they have almost no knowledge about, and, oh, by the way, lose every connection to everyone they've ever known, or stick around because that's the only place they know. Well, I mean, who's surprised that they stick around? But I just think that we're doing those young people such a disservice to not give them the freedoms that you and I as young people enjoyed, and is that nearly every other person in this country does. Yes, are there people living in poverty in this country who are going to have a really hard time living the American dream, whatever that may be? Yeah, probably so. But at least they have some pathways of choice to try to get someplace better. And these folks growing up in this community, those pathways almost don't exist.
Yeah, I see. I think I'm more skeptical about the nature of the pathways that you describe for the average American. Right now, for many of our young people, say the young woman who grows up in a kind of a similar situation in a rural or community or small town in the United States who's not Amish, but has a choice, can go out and get an education, but that it requires a lot of debt. If her family can't pay for a college education, the chances of finding a mate right now are really low. Like, estimate that like 30 to 40% of Gen Z women right now might go unmarried. And so if there's like desire to have a family or like to be a part of a meaningful community, those prospects seem pretty low. The rates of depression, anxiety, loneliness are really high among our young people. I just don't know how many like might say, I would take the Amish path where I kind of know what my future is going to be. I don't have as many individual choices, but I know I'm going to have a place within a community that cares, and I'll have some useful skill that I can do to contribute. Now, I'm not arguing for that kind of trade-off. I'm just saying I wouldn't paint such a big contrast between the two. I think that there's real cost to the kind of life that we have given to our children, that we're passing on to our children. And the cost of the kind of this radical individualism that we're
Which
doing.
Which is not celebrated in the Amish community at all.
It's not at all. But it's what we're handing to our children, but it places a huge burden on them. I just talked 2 weeks ago to this young woman. She's in kind of an enviable position. She was a Rotary exchange student from Brazil, which means that her family's pretty well off probably. And like she's coming in. I was giving my talk about third places and, you know, on how finding yourself place in the community. She comes up and talks to me afterwards and she says, I just want to tell you how much I loved what you were saying about like the importance of like finding real friendships and things. She says, in the past year, I've reduced the time I spend on my cell phone from 12 hours a day to 4 hours a day. This is not an uncommon story. Like 4 hours a day is still a lot.
Yeah,
I think of that as a lot.
Yeah.
She was trying to get it down to two, right? But she was spending 12 hours a day on her phone. We have a lot of young people who are doing this. Like this is their life. I think it's a terrible legacy to be handing to them. When I look at that, I don't think the Amish lifestyle is perfect. Like I agree with you a lot of the like harms and the shortcomings of it, but we have to also appreciate that the life we're giving to many of our young people is not good, and we ought to be. I would rather focus on what we do about that.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Scott, you might have heard the story a couple of weeks ago that during the NFL draft, the teenage son of the Atlanta Falcons general manager made headlines after placing a prank call to college quarterback Shedeur Sanders. And at the time Shedeur Sanders was falling, he was projected to be a first or a top second round pick, and he had fallen. It was way back on day three of the draft. He still wasn't drafted. There's a lot of speculation. Why not? And he gets a prank phone call from this son of the Atlanta Falcons GM, who didn't identify himself, said he was calling from another team, saying like he was about to be drafted. When that prank became public, many fans and a lot of sports commentators immediately called for the general manager of the Falcons to be fired, because he had somehow had that information, had Shedeur Sanders' phone number somewhere in his records, and his teenage son was able to get access to it. The question is that, to what extent are parents responsible for the bad behavior of their children, even in situations like this, where maybe like you weren't as, you didn't keep really close tabs on certain information, but like this was just a teenage prank, and should the parents be responsible for that?
In this case, I don't think the Falcons? Yeah, the general manager of the Falcons has any responsibility over his son's actions. You know, it makes me think of, you know, some of these leaks that have come out of the Pentagon, where we've had some war planning that's been handled in non-confidential ways. I mean, that sort of thing is clearly like stuff that is a true national security issue. We have banking records, we have healthcare records that we have appropriate and strict rules around. But like to say that when you're preparing for draft day, and for those who don't know, that's like a big spectacle. It's televised. It's the first couple of rounds are very closely followed, because many of these players are star college players who are widely known. So this is a big deal. But I don't think I don't know specifics, but it would not surprise me that the GM just had a notepad with key names and contact numbers of players or their agents or what have you, just sort of sitting around his home. I would never think about for a minute that would be like confidential information. And clearly, I don't for a second think what the son did was right. I would imagine that the general manager and his son had some very serious conversations after this that, my guess is, were private and probably should be private. But to say that, I don't know who the general manager of the Falcons reports to, whether it's ownership or there's some level in between, but if I were that person's boss, I might want a little more information, like how this happened. But unless there was some like egregious error, like, hey, here's a list of some players and phone numbers, why do you give them a call? Which I'm sure didn't happen. I don't think that is even close to a fireable offense.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the, I think, the disadvantages of living in this kind of social media age where anything can get out there right away and you can get people piling on.
But
when I first heard about this, I mean, I understand that people were upset. When people get upset, they call for extreme solutions, or at least some people call for extreme
solutions. And they want retribution.
They want retribution. I immediately thought of like the sorts of things that I remember a number of kids doing, where they would sneak in and they would get things from their parents that they weren't supposed to get access to, you know, and tell us about them or do some pranks. And a lot of them would get caught, and they would be punished by their parents.
Yeah.
But nobody else would know about it, right? Because it's not
televised.
It's not televised. I'm interested in that general question. Like, do you think that you should, like, there's some public concern, public legitimacy to concerns with how kids are being raised, or should this be all just private?
I think because this was a public, a talked about public situation, I think if I were this GM for the Falcons, I would, through my employer, put out a statement saying something to the effect, and I bet he did this, but something to the effect of, I as many of you know, my son made what he thought was a prank phone call to a player from a particular school. And according to my son, he got that contact information from me. I certainly regret that this happened. And my son and I have talked this over, and he assures me this will never happen again. And out of respect for my family, and that I think I'd make it clear that the statement I'm making is sort of the only statement I'm going to make on this topic, and kind of close that door, because there are a lot of things as a general manager for an NFL team that you should and will always be talked about, you know, about your roster construction and who you hire as coaching staff, and all those things are all part of the job, and it's a very, very high stress job. But to act like this somehow reflects on your decision making for who to hire as your on your coaching staff, or how to construct your roster for the next season, or how you scout prospects, all those things seem so far removed from this topic. I would, if I were him, I would just address it, say I'm really not going to talk about this again, and just try to and move on from that as quickly as you could. I think you have to apologize, but I don't know what else you can do. And I don't think you need to say, and I grounded him for the next 6 months. I mean, I mean, that doesn't matter.
So keep the private.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's a personal matter, how, whether the son is punished or not. Yeah. That's,
I mean, what is the kid, like 15, 16? I don't know. Something.
Yeah. I can't remember.
I mean, I would be surprised if like 10 years from now that there's not some feature story that some sports journalism writer does about, you know, where is this guy now? And then he'll probably agree to an interview and say, gosh, wasn't I foolish that one day? And kind of do you know, 10 years later, he just feels this was a dumb thing he did. And I mean, it wouldn't be surprising if that story gets written way down the road. But I think right now you just close the door and move on, because this is not something, in my opinion, that reflects on the abilities or the success of this particular sports executive.
What if it's a case, say, that a doctor has information about patients?
Yeah.
Right? And a family member finds out, like, these are highly protected by HIPAA. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't, if you're not directly involved in patient care, you can't get access to other people's medical records, but they've got these records at home, they've got a home office and so forth. A child sneaks in and gets it and publishes something on social media.
Yeah,
about health condition of somebody, like that?
Their high school math teacher. Oh, did you know that Mr. Smith has stage 3 liver cancer?
Yeah. So we do, like, that's a violation of law, but is the parent in that case negligent because they had a family member who was able to sneak into their home office? And
I think maybe a little more. And I've never worked in health care, but I know people who have. And even on people who have much lower on the org chart than a physician, get drilled into them time and time again about privacy rules when it comes to healthcare or medical records, and that they can't, you know, you can't say, oh, I saw, you know, your neighbors in the other day for a cancer screening. I mean, you can't have those conversations. I don't know the details, having not worked in that profession, but I think there is probably pretty specific guidelines when it comes to how those records are handled, especially when you're outside of the office. And I don't know what those are, but my guess is that they are pretty strong and pretty specific. So does that feel different to me than this prank phone call? Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah, because of there's very strict guidelines in place.
Yeah, and
here with the prank phone call, there's information that was highly confidential, but I don't think we have the same kinds of professional guidelines in place about protecting it.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question before we wrap here? So, as anybody who's on social media knows, that if you click on, like, I don't do TikTok, but, like, you know, Facebook has Reels, which is sort of a similar thing. And you click on one video about one thing, and then you sort of get it again. And then if you click on that topic a second time, that's just all you get for a while. And this has happened to me now because I stumbled across, and he's a radio personality, I think. I don't even know where he's based. Nowhere around here. And his name is Jubal. Is his on-air name. And I'm sure he does many things on the air, but one of the things he does on the air is he facilitates prank phone calls. Mm-hmm. And he has like these, and I've listened to enough, so I kind of know how it works, but he has these characters he sort of created. And I'll just give you a quick outline of one is that I listened to one the other day that showed up on my feed that he, and you need help from someone because the only way people fall for these is if you have some sort of predicate that you know something about them or something that sort of fits into something they already know. So they use, so how it works is somebody contacts the radio show, says, I want you to do a prank phone call on my friend, my family member about this particular item. And one, as an example, was this, he called up the other day representing this hotel in, I think it was Hawaii, where this couple was getting ready to vacation in a few weeks or maybe in a week. And he said, well, I'm just calling from this hotel where I know you'll be staying in a week. Well, that right there, you're like, oh, well, this seems legit. I'm staying there. And they go on, and he goes on to tell this woman that he wanted to let her know a few things in advance of the stay, that there is currently a strike on the housekeeping staff, and they don't have any housekeepers, so they'll need to bring their own sheets and blankets and towels because they don't have any housekeeping staff. And, oh, by the way, they should know that there's also a Hell's Angels convention going on at this hotel. And in addition to all of that, there's some significant construction going on the floor above them during this. And of course, as each of these things get piled on, the caller is like getting more and more agitated. This was supposed to be a very, you know, obviously a lot of money to get to Hawaii, and it's supposed to be very restful. And what the no housekeeping, and what the Hell's Angels, and oh my gosh, this construction. And of course, they're, and they just get to the point of just like, just being as angry as can be. And then, I think, in a smart way, he then says, hey, you should know this is a prank phone call. And your husband set you up as he knew you were stressing out about this upcoming trip. And he wanted to do this on you. And in this case, one of the things I find fascinating about this is the reaction. In her case, in this Hawaii hotel incident, she's like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe my husband did that. I just can't wait to talk to him. Oh, I kept hearing those. And then she even said kind of jokingly, like, well, the housekeeping thing seemed bad and the construction thing seemed bad. But, you know, maybe those Hell's Angels would have been fun to have a drink or two with, you know, kind of funny. And, you know,
yeah.
And then some people, you know, so I guess the question for you is, and I should point out that Travis thinks it's ridiculous that I listen to these things. I'm in the corner and they're like 2 or 3 minute reels. And I'm like, oh, this is funny. You have to listen to this one. He's like, this just isn't funny. And do you think this is this something that should be funny, or do you think this is just like a bad choice this radio station's making of kind of preying on people in like, and a lot of them, I should tell you, are around upcoming weddings, like, oh, your venue, like the wedding you have this weekend, we rented the venue out to some internet influencer.
Like when people are at their most highly wound.
Yeah.
And taking your wine up higher. Yeah.
Yeah. And I find and some people like are ha ha ha, I can't believe it. And then a few people, actually one of them, and I think this was like not a put on, is she's like, and was like the daughter calling the mother of the bride about all this stuff, and the bride was set her mom up, and the mother's like, I am so tired of these antics for my daughter, I'm not going to the wedding anymore. Wow. Now she might have changed her mind, but who knows? But I mean, so you think these things are funny, and or you think there is just is
by far that last response funny?
Yeah,
but yeah, I'm not a big fan of those kinds of pranks. I mean, like mildly amusing a little bit, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of energy that goes into them, and I'm not.
So you're not a big person playing pranks on others, then? That's something that you.
I like practical jokes,
okay.
But not of that sort.
Okay, yeah. where you identify someone in, like you said, a sort of vulnerable situation, and then try to
exploit the vulnerability. Yeah, yeah.
That's not good fun for you.
No.
The Ethical Life Podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to check out Rick's column, which is very rarely contains pranks, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.